Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Pharmacy Times Telltale Heart Podcast, a cardiovascular digest for pharmacists. As always, I'm your host, Craig Beavers. We are continuing our coverage of the European Society of Cardiology. This is on our normal schedule. If you listened late, last Friday, I published kind of the update with our panelists about some of the trials that they talked about. But I have a new insight and some new data on some of the newer trials today. And I'm excited to introduce my guest here in a moment. We'll get a global perspective. This is the first time we've had an international guest on the podcast. So it'll be fun. And you'll probably get to hear him in the future too. He's been a great partner that I've gotten to meet and work with on a variety of different things in the last several years. For the last year or so. But just as always, if you are interested in contributing to the podcast, you have comments about ESC things, like, subscribe, send us your messages, questions. We're going to probably be doing ESC content, the European Society of Cardiology content, for the next several episodes, which will probably take us right into HFSA, the Heart Failure Society of America, and the American Heart Association meeting, where this whole cycle will begin. With that being said, I'm not going to wait further ado and get to the what everyone really cares about, and that's hearing about the data. So I'm going to welcome Lauren. Lauren, tell us who you are, where you work, what you do. So.
I'm Laurens van der Linde. I'm a Belgian pharmacist. I'm a hospital pharmacist. In Belgium, you're either a community pharmacist, an industry pharmacist, or a hospital pharmacist. I myself am a hospital pharmacist, so I'm active at the University Hospitals in Leuven. Leuven is a small student city, not far from the capital of Belgium, Brussels. And there I'm active in almost 2,000-bed hospital, where I think the majority of my activities pertain to clinical work, clinical pharmacy work, and also some academic work, because I've also been appointed to the university, the alma mater of UZ Leuven, which is the Catholic University of Leuven. That's
Yeah,
exactly it. Yeah.
that's awesome. And I know you've been very progressive in doing cardiovascular disease in Belgium, or at least for pharmacists in that standpoint. I know, you and I have talked about, how pharmacists can be engaged with heart failure and other things. But it's been great learning. I always enjoy learning in the pharmacy practice and models of everybody in the world and globally, and how we all can elevate pharmacists. And that's part of the conversation that Lauren's has. Like, he's like, how do I get to do this in my world? And we've talked about that, and he's done it. He's proven his worth. So, yeah.
Have you actually tried to copy what you are doing, Greg? So
Yeah,
we
no,
are just literally
it's awesome.
copy-paste.
So he, so prolific. He and I, not to self-promote, but we just had a meta-analysis of pharmacists in heart failure and the role of them in terms of readmissions and management that was just published in the British Journal of
Oh,
Pharmacology, excuse me,
clinical pharmacology, yeah. I think
clinical
the main
pharmacology.
Exactly. I think the main point of that analysis is, when you take a look at all the data, it has to do with, I think, the clinical benefits related to our job, to clinical pharmacy services. And it would like make a super table of all clinical pharmacy services and meta-analysis. There's one topic that sits lonely at the top, and that's like cardiovascular pharmacotherapy, particularly with the focus on heart failure. AFib, antithrombotic stewardship. There we have quite convincing evidence. It's actually difficult to argue against now, I think, the body of evidence, which I think we've added to a little bit with our recent meta-analysis, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's always reassuring, especially because there's obviously newer data that comes out, and that's what we were able to do and just further enhance or confirm, what that role is. And not that people doubt it, but it's always something, especially as time evolves and clearly as the disease states get more complex. I think it's more prudent or realistic to have a pharmacist, especially when you wade into HFpEF and you're like, well, now we have to consider maybe they have amyloid, or there are other things that start becoming that overlap. But anyways, we're not here to talk about heart failure today. We're going to talk about trials from ESC. Lawrence is passionate and wanted to talk about two trials. He wanted to talk about the Alone AF trial and the Aquatics trial. So we're going to jump in and talk about the Alone AF trial first. So Lawrence, tell us, for people who didn't get to hear a background, or what was this trial about? Where was it pl take place? What did they do? And then we'll kind of break down what our thoughts are. So.
So the thing is, whenever someone undergoes catheter ablation for AFib and they then remain in sinus rhythm, the question is, what to do? Should you then just continue your anticoagulation, or should you apply some form of watchful waiting and discontinue your anticoagulation? The guidelines are currently, or the guideline recommendations are currently based on post hoc studies, some observational work, but we didn't really have any RCT-based evidence up until now. So that's, I think, the added value of the ALONE-AF trial. And there might be some criticisms. There are always some criticisms, of course, and some comments here and there. But that I think the added value of that trial is that they were the first to actually investigate it in the setting of an RCT. So I also have taken the liberty to add some like previous evidence just to think about like the added value, because we do know some things about how to deal with sinus rhythm versus AFib, and to what extent this should inform your antithrombotic regimen in AFib. And I think one of the main studies that still inform the way that we deal with anticoagulation in AFib is the AFFIRM trial. There, like it's 20, 30 years ago, there, well, we were learned a particular lesson that even when you achieve sinus rhythm, it's unwise to stop anticoagulation because you pay a price. You pay a price, and you see an increase in strokes. So, okay, AFFIRM taught us, don't stop anticoagulation. And EAST AFNET4 taught us that it might be interesting to increase your time in sinus rhythm, to restore sinus rhythm in as much patients as possible, as soon as possible. It might all be the case that it was not because of the sinus rhythm, but because of the fact that patients in the intervention arm in EAST AFNET4 just saw their healthcare professionals a lot more and adhered more to their therapies. That's another discussion. But then we had Cabana trial, which compared ablation versus usual care, and then the impact of ablation on time in sinus rhythm, patient burden, but also hard clinical outcomes. And that was actually a neutral trial. So we got AFFIRM, don't stop anticoagulation when you reach sinus rhythm in AFib. The EAST AFNET4 trial, more sinus rhythm is probably better. And then the question is then, can ablation improve your time in sinus rhythm, enhance your clinical outcomes? That was a little bit unsure in Cabana, but now we have ALONE-AF. And ALONE-AF, actually, they started quite smart. They enrolled patients who underwent a catheter ablation for at least 12 months ago. And those patients remained in sinus rhythm for at least 12 months. And after those 12 months, they were randomized 1-to-1 ratio to continue anticoagulation or discontinue anticoagulation. It was an open label study, so that's important. It's an open label study. Most patients were low to intermediate stroke risk, so the average CHA2DS2 was 2, excluding the sex-based risk factor. About 30% even only had a score of 1. A lot of males, average age was about 75 to 70, was superiority based trial. It was powered to detect a difference in the primary outcome of 9.2 versus 4.2, which is, if you think about it, that's an absolute difference of 5% points, which is, I think, a lot. Also, the primary endpoint was a composite endpoint, which included an ischemic portion and a bleeding component. So the strokes, the emboli, but also bleeding, which is also a little bit strange in these type of discontinuation trials, because it always favors the discontinuation arm. If you include bleeding or bleeds in that outcome, you will favor that specific safety outcome. They followed patients for 2 years. And indeed, it was a successful trial. So the primary outcome was reduced, but the event rate was really low, really low. So they expected 9 versus 4. And they found actually more something in the range of 1 to 2%. So a lot lower than expected. And the primary outcome was completely driven by reduction in bleeds. So we've got an open label trial performed in South Korea with quite a stable population, which was actually quite at low to intermediate stroke risk, where they reduced the incidence of bleeds. So it's not like we now for sure can state that this is the way to go. Also, the low number of events doesn't really make the results so robust. If just few patients would not have experienced a bleed in the intervention group, or some more patients experienced one or two more bleeds in the control group, the primary analysis would not have been significant anymore. So it has a very low fragility index, this type of analysis. So I do like the study for sure, because again, I think we now know that it opens a discussion that you can have with patients if they have underwent a successful catheter ablation for AFib, they don't have any recurrence. Well, if you have, because that's important as well, because it's a little bit hidden in the paper and in the protocol, and they're not so explicit about it. If a patient had a recurrence of AFib, then they did receive anticoagulation. So if you do this, then you have to provide a means to detect and screen for AFib so that those patients can directly be reinitiated, restarted with their anticoagulation. Mortality rates were very low. All-cause mortality was zero. Stroke rates were low. Not a lot of women. In this study, most were men, so only a quarter of the study cohort were female. Also, I think that's important to mention because the minimum amount of time that was needed was 12 months. So the catheter ablation and then the randomization, the minimum time was 12 months, but the actual time was a lot more. So it's almost 3 years I wrote down. So a lot of the patients were low risk, stable, and followed up adequately before trial enrollment. So they were low risk. I think that's the main thing that we have to take into account. These were not high risk patients. These were
Sure.
not elderly patients. These were not polymedicated patients. So it's novel. It adds to the data. It adds to the evidence of AFFIRM, ESTEF-NET4, Cabana. And it opens up the discussion, but for a lot of like intermediate to high risk patients, older patients, patients with an increased stroke risk, I'm not too sure whether I would like to not propose anticoagulation in those patients. Rather the opposite.
I think to all your points, 100% valid. And I think about this in a lot of terms with AFib. I'd be interested how you guys are doing this and or thinking about it in, in Belgium, because everybody's health system and care delivery is obviously different in versus the US or not. But I mean, to your point, these are what appears to be lower risk patients in that sense. And just to add to this, and this is to say, we know this is all South Korean population. A lot of those patients are more, Asian populations are more likely to bleed on anticoagulation. So inherently, they may already have an enhanced risk. So what does this look like in a European or an American population? Do the results appear as enhanced from that standpoint? I think, implementation-wise, your point is absolutely dead on. Assuring that people are doing these Holters and following up, and that they're not an AFib, but for that period, of course, you're taking a time captured window of this. But I look at it too is like, this is great data. I love that we're getting data like this. However, I'm curious what this data is going to look in the context as we look at a couple of different other management strategies that could be coming down the pipeline. And one of those is, for example, left atrial appendage. I don't know if you guys do left atrial appendage closure pretty regularly in Belgium. But they're about to have the CHAMPION trial published next year, which is comparing left atrial appendage with the WATCHMAN device to head-to-head comparison versus direct-acting anticoagulant. Of course, you can now place the devices during an ablation, right? And then in the 45 days, in theory, you could stop the anticoagulant. And my question is like, Is this trial even this trial today that you presented, is that depending on what the champion is this still valid in domain? And it is helpful to have because there are going to be patients you encounter either don't want a device or something to that effect.
Or younger people who like to do sports
Correct.
and who, yeah, so the like wrestling or martial arts
Yeah.
stuff like that,
Yeah,
where you
like you, like you're a wrestler. Yeah.
where you hit your head, or skiing or
Yeah.
mountain biking,
Well,
because
and to your point about younger patients, the beauty of this trial is like to the point of that low risk factor profile.
exactly,
If we
yeah.
start managing AFib earlier and doing this catheter-based strategy sooner and really focusing to your point about all that background, the reason he presented all this background is we know, and Affirm kind of confirmed this. Affirm is interesting because yes, while it was a narrow population, we know that sinus rhythm is actually a good thing. Being in sinus, the problem with Affirm was antiarrhythmics, and we know this as pharmacists, they are not good drugs. They are terrible drugs. It's actually funny if you look at the Affirm hazard curves, it's like normal sinus is here good, but it is completely offset by the toxicities of the antiarrhythmic drugs. Like that is like the piece to that. So if we can do it with strategies that are safer and more effective, and of course we're getting better with ablation and the way we map and do and with PFA and all the things. So the point, if we can capture these patients earlier, then to your point, Lawrence, as they're younger, they may not want to be on anticoagulation because they're still doing
No.
things
Yeah.
and so then they don't want to be committed to this long-term journey. So
So I think that they opened like a door for a certain subset of patients. And also they added to the evidence base. So I think for sure there's added value, and it's a good exercise for journal clubs if you want to like really delve into the statistics of a trial and really scrutinize how they did it and think about event rates. Hey, what does it mean if you only have like a third of the expected event rate? What does it mean?
Sure. Well, in generalizability, right?
Yeah,
Is this
exactly.
generalized to the group that we're seeing or asking those questions? To your point, it's important data. I'm glad we have it, and it encourages us to continue to ask this question. And naturally, I think to the point, the next question becomes: as we get better at ablation, could that window be shorter? Does it have to be that we wait 12 months? You know what I mean? Could it be 6 months of monitoring and then take them off? Especially as we get better monitoring systems, to your point, if we have more continuous monitors, if we have what I suspect or what I have seen or something, we'll see the evolution of these trials that will add technologies that say, yeah, maybe we can shorten the duration and then monitor them a little bit more and then determine if they need to be back on it is what we'll see as we get different monitoring strategies and just become so much better at ablation. So
In the ALONE-AF trial, it was, I think, about 10% suffered was suffered experienced a reoccurrence of AFib with a median time of like I think 12 months after randomization. So
okay.
1 in 10,
Yeah.
which is high enough that you have to provide a
Sure.
screening pro a follow-up program,
Well, and
which
like to
is
your point, the
yeah.
patients we see a lot of, like heart failure patients or those patients, I would still not feel comfortable like, oh, I'm going to stop your AFib, your
No, I
anticoagulant
agree.
because they have risk and things to that effect. So it was a great study. It has a lot of good things to your point. Great from the data perspective in terms of adding to the cardiovascular, but to your point about even just that academic exercise of what the trial design it is good from that standpoint, but very good. And just as a side note, and I know the answer to this, but I'm just like, you didn't get to go to Madrid this year. Normally you go
No.
to ESC,
Yep.
correct? So
I
yeah,
tried
you had
to.
some conflicts. Yeah, no worries. That's all right. N normally he you would see him there in person in presence. So all right, but
It's definitely very difficult to like really consume all the information looking at the screen or looking at the paper. It's always best to just visit the meeting. There's nothing as effective or efficient, time efficient, to just attend the meeting itself.
oh, and especially
It's
this
always
year,
the
because there
best.
is so
Yeah.
many great trials. It
Yeah,
was like, oh.
it's good. I think the number of concomitant trials in high impact factor journals was something like 150 or 160, which means that you have to like read up on 150 papers,
Yeah.
and so that's it's always best within the meeting. But I was
Yeah, no,
unfortunate
absolutely.
that I couldn't
Well,
attend now.
and I always take interest, and this is a side note, like I always take interest in, because a lot of times during these studies, they'll release the European guidelines updates for certain things, like they did valvular heart disease, and I think they had a statement about managing hypercholesterolemia or hyper. I always like to see what, I always feel like you guys are always ahead of the curve a little bit on some things, so I like to see what you guys are thinking about things in the European context and how that was going to be, similar or different from what the American context is going to be.
I don't know whether I share that sentiment because, like, with for the heart failure guidelines, well, your guidelines, US guidelines, I think we're a little bit ahead with regard to how to approach HFpEF, and they took into account a lot more of the granularity of the actual trial data. And so, of course, there might be difference in assigning grades of
Sure.
evidence and strengths of recommendations, and there might be a little bit more rigor on your European side. Yeah, of course, but the studies have been done. So, like with TOPCAT and the TOPCAT Americas analysis, that was something that was not mentioned in the ESC guys, but it was
Sure.
always mentioned in the US guidelines. So,
Yeah,
I think,
and to your point, pros and cons, yeah.
pros and cons, also somewhat nicer figures.
Well, you guys have, I feel like you guys have nicer figures for sure. Yeah, no, I, in fact, someone on X or Twitter or whatever you want to call one of our pickers, or maybe he texted, I won't disclose the person's name, but texted to a group of us that are, they're like, why do the Europeans have better figures than the American journals? And I don't, so maybe that's just culturally different.
Perhaps,
So anyways.
in Dutch we would call it het gras is groener aan de andere kant. I suppose in English it would be the grass is always greener on the other side,
Sure,
perhaps.
right?
That
Yeah,
makes
absolutely. But you know what? Here's the best part. It doesn't matter. I learn from, reading yours. You guys learn from us. It's a great context and review, and sometimes it's thought-provoking because there are sometimes, to your point, either grading differences or minor nuances, and it's like, okay, here's where they're approaching it from this perspective, or just because they're not on the same cycle. You can see, like, well, they're already talking about this, and we haven't gotten to there yet. You know what I mean? From that standpoint. But okay,
There's
so
a
we're
lot
going
of
to move on to the
comparisons.
next one. So this one created quite a stir in a good way. Again, not a surprising data, but a very important set of data. Tell us about aquatic.
So also here, it's I think interesting to start from the very beginning. If you think about the coronary artery disease patient, they have a chance that they might also have to take anticoagulation for something else. So it's a 10 to 15% chance that they also have AFib for which they have to take anticoagulation. So there's an overlap. The conundrum then is, what do we have to do? In the acute setting, we know what to do. We have a lot of trials. In the subacute setting, up to 6 to 12 months, we have it started with WUST. We have the REDUCE PCI trial, AUGUSTUS and TRUST AF PCI. We have several trials. We know what to do. And that information from those trials has already been incorporated in the guidelines. So we know what to do with triple therapy, with dual therapy, which molecules to pursue, and we know how to de and how important bleeding risk is. And it was all it's already one of the things that was shown in the early Dutch WUST trial. If you bleed, you stop your antithrombotic. If you stop
Right.
your antithrombotic in that period, you will experience more thrombotic events. So lowering the bleeding risk might also translate in lowering the thrombotic risk, but the risks might change in that dynamic landscape over time. So up to 12 months, it's quite certain what we have to do. WUST, the DOAC trials, guidelines, we have it. And then after 12 months, and I'm lucky because recently a meta-analysis was published that actually did all the heavy lifting. We have four trials, 4,000 patients, and I think the biggest ones, which were published in New England, those are well known, the AFIRE and the EPICAT trial. I think all of them almost show the same thing. All of them were open label. That's one important thing. So they're all open label trials in stable coronary artery disease patients who had also AFib. And then they were randomized to a monotherapy with an oral anticoagulant arm versus anticoagulant plus an antiplatelet. So those were open label trials. They were powered for bleeds. So they were underpowered for ischemic events, of course, because all of them were taking antithrombotics. And all of them were conducted in East Asian populations, which we can also link to the previous study because,
The bleeding risk,
yeah, the
yeah.
bleeding risk. Yeah. I think I don't have anything against the other trials, but I think the most informative of those trials was AFIRE, which was stopped prematurely due to a negative impact of the add-on antiplatelet arm. And combined, those four trials have taught us that it's wise to stop the antiplatelet agent and to pursue monotherapy with an oral anticoagulant. So that's like one thing. In the meta-analysis, no increase in ischemic events was observed. But across those four RCTs, most patients were not really high risk. They were not really someone with a PCI with multiple standing or PCI with diabetes and CKD, not with a PCI for an ACS. So it was a lower risk patient population. Actually, if you compare it like the PCI patients across those four studies, it was about 70% had a PCI. So it was a lower risk patient population from that perspective. Also, AFIRE was the biggest one. EPICAT was a little bit smaller, but there they did like the same thing where they combined an endpoint with bleeds and ischemic events, which for this type of setting I personally do not like. So the evidence is still quite, well, not that convincing. Not a lot of ischemic events, Asian-only cohorts, open label, and I think a part of those questions are actually resolved now with aquatic. We have now a double-blind study. I think that's important. It's not limited to AFib patients. It's like an all-comer antico population. And there they did not standardize the antico arm, but they standardized the antiplatelet arm. In the other studies, you could take clopidogrel or ticlopid, whatever, whichever that you would like to take. But here it's just aspirin or no aspirin. So it was a double-blind study in France. All-comer population with regard to anticoagulation and then randomization to aspirin or no aspirin. The study included particularly high-risk patients, particularly when you compare it to the previous four RCTs. For instance, PCI plus PCI for an ACS. If it was a PCI longer than 6 months ago, you had to have an additional risk factor, for instance, diabetes or PAD, CKD. And this will translate also in higher event rates, much higher event rates, actually, which allows to detect larger difference, or you don't need as large a sample to detect a difference. It was also a superiority design. I think I've covered like the main basics. Yep. And the primary efficacy endpoint was highly significant. So it was 17 versus 12 percent. And the primary safety outcome was 10 versus 3%. So here we have now actually rather convincing results. That indeed, even in those high-risk patients, high risk in terms not of their bleeding risk, but in terms of their ischemic risk, that monotherapy is to be preferred over a combination with antiplatelet agent. In this case, it was aspirin 100 milligrams once daily. Yeah, personally, I don't have they address a high-risk group. It was double-blind. It's we now have data in a Caucasian or in a European or in Western population. It's in line with the current guideline recommendations. I checked the ESC guidelines. It's now mentioned in three subsequent guidelines for ACS, AFib, and the management of chronic coronary syndromes. And in each study, it's approached from a different perspective and it gets another type of recommendation. I think the best one is now from the ESC guidelines of 24 for CCS, where it's actually just 1A recommendation to do the right thing, which includes stopping the anti-platelet agent after 12 months in those very high-risk patients. So I think here it's interesting that it was actually all across the board, that there was no added value of giving an antiplatelet agent, even in this high-risk patient population. So for me, this was a little bit more clear-cut than the ALONE-F trial, personally.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. It adds on to the variety of literature, and I think you alluded to this. Most of the patients were on DOACs or direct-acting ammonium anticoagulants. Very few on vitamin K. There was some, which to me, vitamin K even has an even higher propensity or risk to causing bleeding events. And to your point about WOST and all the things to that effect, we know.
Yeah, sure. Like in the Augustus trial, that was an effect. Yeah, for sure. The
Yeah.
highest event rate was with warfarin plus aspirin. The lowest was then with the DOAC without aspirin. Yeah, for sure. It was a
Correct.
plus aspirin that made it worse.
Absolutely. And so it adds on to this concurrent data of, here is this, and more importantly, it takes this time frame and says, okay, here's the 6 month period. And hopefully to the point, your point about the large sample size and all the things that people will feel very comfortable in that, because a lot of times, or larger sample size, a lot of people have, issues or concerns about some of these trials, and some of them have been smaller, and ultimately when you include all the patients together, it's a decently sized trial, meaning other trials, and when you look at this. But I do like what your point is. Granted, most of these patients had AFib, and we've seen that they did try to take all comers to some extent, which is something we've not seen in some of
No,
the
and
other
most
trials.
of them had AFib, so it was almost by definition still it was an AFib trial.
Right. And unlike the others that we've seen, this was not, historically people have done these non-inferiority trials, right? Looking at, and a lot of that's been driven by bleeding and death, but this looked at it in terms of a true efficacy, superiority standpoint. Let me ask you this question. I mean, what are you guys doing already in your practice or in your hospital? And you talked about this kind of at the beginning, anticoagulation stewardship, and you think about anticoagulation forum and the pharmacist role and stewardship. Are you guys, aggressively removing aspirin on these patients? Are you looking for patients that are inappropriately still being treated with aspirin to stop therapy? Is that what, or is this going to enhance your practice to do those things?
We do have, so I think also important is because I know that they were going to delve a little bit deeper because I didn't touch upon it. So the is that it's not only the increase in high risk of cardiovascular death in the primary outcome, but also like the risk of death. That was, I think, the
Yeah, no, please go into it. Save these, break
So
this
it's,
out.
yeah, you could argue, okay, if it's just like an increase in bleeds or, and then those bleeds might inform discontinuing something and you might see some MI, but it's also like the harder translation of those outcomes, like the mortality related ones that were impacted to such an extent. So also perhaps this one might also be a good one for a journal club to delve a little bit deeper into like
Yeah.
the results of this trial. Because aspirin has always had like a reputation of being very safe, like a panacea, like a golden bullet. It can do everything, a magic bullet. It started, I think, with Averoes or Averoes, where we saw that it might not be the case. And then we had all the other trials that we just mentioned, where adding something might not translate into some benefit. And now it's not only that it might not provide the benefit, but it might also like kill. Well, kill is strongly, it's too strong. It might harm patients severely.
Yeah, no, I think it to your point, we've gotten so comfortable with aspirin, but then we forgot it. And of course, again, this may be a very American comment to make, right? So I apologize, but and you would appreciate this, but like aspirin is considered over the counter. Like you don't need a prescription. You can get it, and people associate that with safety. And when I say people, the general public, everyone's like aspirin has no risk. And so there's that narrative, and it really actually it does have risk, and especially the way that we're using it. And I know it's available in over the counter in Europe in that construct as well, but it just because of that, it has had such a large reputation of there's nothing that aspirin, it doesn't cause problems, but it really does from the, and even we saw this, and I'm going to go way back when we, not way back, but we looked in the Capri trial when they looked at aspirin and clopidogrel head to head in patients. Capri was actually better because of this the safety piece. No, different mechanism, but I mean people forget about, in theory, clopidogrel is probably a better agent than aspirin for I'm not that's a, I'm not making that bold of a statement, but when you look at it in that context, it's like, clopidogrel is safer, clearly because it doesn't have the GI bleeding events. So
In Belgium, aspirin is, we have it over the counter, but the when you use it in secondary cardiovascular prevention and the doctor prescribes it, then it's reimbursed. And if it's
yeah.
reimbursed, then you need a prescription. So the
Gotcha.
reimbursed one that it's that is really indicated according to the guidelines, that one is reimbursed. The standard, that's a standard reimbursement. And in our hospital, we have board-based activities on, for instance, geriatric unit, the ED unit, and there we do include the basic principles of antithrombotic stewardship for sure. So the add-on aspirin will be discontinued.
Yeah. So, I think this one's interesting because it's not just bleeding. I think what I took away this is it's not just that we're preventing the bleeding, but there's actually a death component to this, and
It
that
all goes
we.
back to Woest. I think the people from the Netherlands, they felt it what it meant if you experience a bleed in a high-risk situation. If you experience a
Sure.
bleed, you stop your antithrombotic, you pay a price. And the
Yeah.
bleed also activates your coagulation. So
Correct. Yeah, it's actually coagulation activation, but also, if you have, to your point, if you have the problem where you stop things and people then don't get the treatment and all the things that are tied with that, and that's the natural recurrence. We've seen when people stop antiplatelets or anticoagulants in the data that it takes a while for people to put them back on, and what that looks like, or they pick an inappropriate strategy that may be appropriate for the patient. So, very good. Lawrence, this was amazing. I hope to bring you on again. I hope someday I get to come and visit you in Belgium. I think that would be
Always welcome.
amazing. So, I didn't prep you for this. And if you don't have an answer, so please don't feel compelled and you can be like, I'm not sure, I wasn't ready for this. But I always ask my guests a non-clinical type question, and that is if you wanted to, what non-pharmacy or cardiology thing are you reading, or are you watching, or are you listening to podcasts, books, music, movie? Like, what is something that you've been like, this is what I've been currently, when I don't think about pharmacy, I think about this, or I've been thinking about this.
So with regard to sports, it's wrestling or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or a combination thereof. With regard to the podcast, it's the Magnus Archives, and the rest is history. That's the rest is history. I cannot. They are awesome. It's j
And what are
just
they? I'll have to look this up. So what is the
those are
construct?
two published historians. And they talk about little tidbits of history,
Okay.
like who
I'm
was
gonna
the
have to
most
look this
famous,
up.
who was the most famous dog? Which
I'm
monkeys
looking this
played an
up right
important,
now.
which monkeys played an important role?
So the rest is history.
The importance of Marie Antoinette in the French Revolution, stuff like that. So The rest is history. And the Magnus Archives is when you're going for a walk in a dark forest, that's the type of podcast that you want to listen. A little bit of
Okay.
like Lovecraftian horror. And with regard to like TV and streaming, my wife has started looking at, but it's all in the US. It's, I think it's a couple of years old. Schitt's Creek.
Yeah, yes, we've very
Yeah.
funny show. Very funny show.
Yeah, that
Oh
one.
man, this okay, so I'm gonna listen to both of these. And then
Yeah.
so the last thing I would ask you, if people
Yeah.
wanted to find you, I mean, or do you have a social media presence? Do you have a faculty page? How would, and you don't have to, if you don't want them to find you, that's okay. You know, I don't
I
want people to
suppose
find.
Lawrence van der Linde at LinkedIn will
Okay.
be, I think, just my name.
Sure.
LinkedIn. Normally there should only be one, I think.
Sure.
Otherwise, there is a guy with my name who breeds goats, but that's
Oh
not the
yeah,
Lawrence van der Linde
that's
that
not
you're
who I
looking
am.
for.
He'll
That's not
be
the one.
very confused when you're talking about
Yes.
heart failure,
Yeah.
you know, the heart
Yeah.
failure in the British Journal of Clinical
Yeah.
Pharmacology.
Yeah.
He'll be like, I don't know
That's
what you're talking about. So, is he also in Belgium? I assume he's in Belgium.
Yes.
Okay, so
Yes.
that's
Yes.
funny.
Yeah,
So,
I know.
okay, well, very good. Well, I thank you for your time. I know you're up late doing this, so I appreciate it. Always good to catch up with you, and thank you for being here. So.
Thank you. Okay.
So thank you to my audience. As always, like, subscribe. If you have comments, give us a five. If you want to be on the show, you have comments, questions, things we want to cover, content, please let me know. We're always here to meet your needs and be a tool for education. So thank you all. Have a good one.